Welcome. It's August 18th, 2016, and this is Radio Free Nintendo. I am your host, James Jones. I'm joined today by Mr. Greg Leahy.
Yo, hoy, hoy, everyone.
Greg, preseason football.
It's a hell of a thing, isn't it?
I got a power outage during one game and thought, this is fine. This is better. I'm okay with this.
I think it's best to just wear it wearing knee braces in sympathy. That's really all that matters.
John Lindemann is out today getting hair plugs for the 35th time. What he's actually doing is he's trying to find more youth he can siphon to restore his lost vitality, but we use the term hair plugs here because otherwise it sounds gross and sexual or violent.
I am looking forward to John in the sort of all-male reboot of Death Becomes Her.
So, without John this week, we brought in somebody that you may have heard before, guest. Well, I guess we'll call him a guest. But you should do him, Mr. Guillaume Veillette, is that right?
Yeah, sure. I've been listening to the last few episodes, and there's really nothing that is worth commenting on. The 3 weeks vacation stuff, the most Canadian rankings, it's like, whatever.
The most Canadian rankings was supposed to get, like, hyper cut down, but that episode is so goddamn long that at some point, like, I just stopped caring and I didn't cut that segment at all.
Yeah, you very clearly state your intent to cut that part out, and then we can hear a second introduction, and then, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, like I left it on purpose, but I left it out of apathy. It wasn't an editing mistake. It was an editing not caring. I spent too much time putting horns in the episode, so I was just like, fuck this, I'm not gonna fix this.
But yeah, for the record, I don't get 3 weeks. That would be awesome. I get 3 weekends. I get 2 weeks. It's just, you know, I'm not gonna come back early from my vacation to edit this podcast. Are you fucking kidding me?
Guillaume, you and your Canadian 6 month vacations, how does anything get fucking done up there?
It doesn't. That's how I get time to do this.
But yeah, John's out preying on the youth of playing on the preying on lost youth. So instead, I can't even get that out. It's so fucking stupid.
It is, but you stick with it. It's impressive.
John Lindemann is a vampire. I have the evidence to prove it. Skin should not be that gout otherwise. So we have an episode of a podcast to do. This episode would actually be, if you followed numbering, 889. And...
what?
Fuck me! 489!
That's the weirdest mistake yet.
I'm having a hard time. Guillaume's been gone 3 weeks. We've been gone two. Like, I'm out of the loop here. So, we're going to start this episode that may or may not have a number. And some people may know that number. I am apparently not amongst those people. I do know that means we are perilously close to a number that is round and therefore people concerned about it. We got to take some time off for reasons we'll talk about some other point. But also, I did want to talk about that Nintendo World Report. We'll be doing our Child's Play Telethon. I haven't even told these guys about it yet. Hi, guys.
Hey.
It's going to be in October this year. I'll have the date when we've got it firmly locked down. But Neil and I have started planning it, and we started rounding up people, and it's not going to be run by me all this year, so by the end, you won't hear somebody moaning that they want to die. So...
No, I think well, that's premature.
Well, don't promise that.
Yeah. Let me put it this way.
If we could go along with the way this episode's going, you might hear it at the end of tonight. Bloody hell.
Fine. It's the magic of editing. So... Now that I've said that, none of this will get cut out. But that's okay. We're going to talk about video games and video game related topics here because that's what we do on this podcast. It's called Nintendo World Report. So let's get started. Guillaume!
Jesus, you're really hyper. So I was on vacation. Part of my vacation involved spending, quiet time at a cottage, except that it was with the in-laws and they've got young kids. So quiet time at the cottage really means, trying to avoid kids most of the week, and when they find you, they want to play games with you. And so, like, we brought the Wii to that cottage, and the kids, when they were playing by themselves, they would usually play Oops Prank Party. but on the Wii, which is not a good game. It's made by the regular Wii Party, Mario Party folks. What's her name? ND Cube or something?
ND Cube, yes.
So, but it's really, like, it's published by Hudson, and it's terrible. But the kids love it for some reason. I think it's because you get kind of Mii lookalikes. They can't afford Mii's. So, you know, you've got your customized avatars wearing, like, Bee costumes, and you can force them...
They can't afford Mii's. Doesn't Nintendo have some skin in the game at NDQ?
Well, apparently they don't care enough to give Hudson access. Yeah. So, anyway, it's really bad. But so, you know, sometimes I would try to be a good, I don't know.
Tangential relative.
Yeah. Anyway, someone who knows their aunt and a good
associate.
Adult. Sure. Fine. A responsible person. And I would, sometimes I sat down and played a couple of games of Mario Party 9 with them. And I'm not a Mario Party fan. I was kind of away from Nintendo gaming in general back in the N64 days. And once I got a GameCube, Mario Party was not exactly the franchise that I was really the most excited to discover. And in fact, I might have thought when I saw whatever commercials, when I heard about Mario Party on the N64, my thought might have been like, wow, Mario has jumped the shark. but
oh, that was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Well, you know, like the other spinoffs, like Mario Golf and stuff, were actually good. But Mario Party just didn't seem like a multiplayer only kind of like board game. That's, you know, like it didn't seem with just mini games. It didn't seem that interesting to me. And from what I've played of the N64 games, from what I've played of two, it's not really my thing because I don't get the point, you know, like you roll the dice and the games never seem to go anywhere. Like you can set the maximum number of turns and it's just like no one seems to complete a turn or someone goes around the board and it just feels pointless in the end. But I find that Mario Party 9 solves
Mario
a lot
Party
of the
nine-nilism?
Nine. What?
that joke works better in writing.
Also, I kind of talked over you, but I'll get it in editing, and I'm sure it's really funny.
It's the best.
Okay, so Mario Party 9 solves a lot of the problems that I have with this series. First, it solves the issue of the kind of the off-brand looking Mario models. The graphics are quite good, so I don't have any complaints there. Toad looks like Toad. Mario looks like Mario. The one issue that remains is that the physics might not be what you expect them to be in the minigames. You know, Wario jumps the same as Luigi? I don't think so. But that's why I choose Mario as my character all the time, because you kind of get the physics that you expect from that guy. But yeah, so the graphics are good. It looks quite nice. And also, because all the players share one ride on the board and take turns throwing the dice, you kind of get kind of a complete, not a story, but you get from point A to point Z, you know. The boards are designed, most of them anyway, some of them are circular, some of them, you know, like you do loops, but most of them, like there's a beginning and an end and there's a progression. You know, so if you take like the haunted castle stage, you start and then like as you travel through the mansion, there are these ghosts, these boos inside. You pass in front of portraits of boos, and they come out of it and they chase you. And so if you roll less than a 3, then you're gonna get caught by them and you're gonna lose stars. And so it becomes kind of a game of, you know, like you're trying maybe to screw over the other people, that like the person who's going to play after you, by purposefully not doing too well and then having them get caught by the boos and stuff like that. So there's some strategy involved there. But also just the fact that, you know, there's a progression, you get followed by boos, you get to the end and, you know, it's a little bit more interesting, you know, or you'll have another board where there's lava rising up at some point. So again, like you're trying to roll as high as you can, otherwise lava touches you and you lose progress. So I really enjoyed that. I don't know, like the mini games were pretty good. And I find that, you know, Mario Party, one of the things that everyone says about it is that it's kind of random who wins and who loses. In fact, it's almost not random. It's almost sure that you get punished for doing well.
Yeah, losing is winning.
Yeah, but I haven't found that to be the case in Mario Party 9. So I was playing against, you know, an 8-year-old that I just trounced. His older sister.
Did you make him cry? Did you make him cry?
I made him whine, which is worse. His older sister was doing much better. And the grandma, I don't know, was somewhere in between. And so I could, I just wiped the floor with them. It was great. It felt great. But unfortunately, eventually, the grandma got tired of the game and, Karen jumped in, and she doesn't have more of a history with Mario Party. But she is kind of a shark at it anyway, because what we found out is that the timing... So, yeah, when you roll the dice, your character, you know, you press the A button and the character will jump, like, you know, to hit a coin block and will stop the dice. And so you can see the numbers change on the dice as it's rolling in midair, and you can actually determine the outcome. You know, if there's a 1 at the top of that dice and you hit A right at the exact time, then you're going to get a 1. You're going to roll a 1. And Karen has an uncanny ability to always get the number that she wants. The way that the die rolls in midair, like there's, you can almost get 4s pretty consistently, because for whatever reason, like the 4 stays up all the time, but Karen could get like any number that she wanted. So when she was playing, I was, you know, I was like 2nd or worse if I was unlucky. So anyway, it's a good game. Like, I really enjoyed it. And I'm not sure, you know, I think that Mario Party 10 follows sort of the same formula, at least like the whole, the everyone cars. Shares a car. Yeah. And travels around the board together. That is reprised, but it didn't get as good reviews. And, I'm not sure why, but,
So we had a, it may have been at PAX or maybe it was at an E3. I don't remember, but there was a reason that I was with other NWR people at mm-hmm. night with booze. And we played Mario Party 9. This was my first
I think it was at PAX, and I think I was I think I missed it. Like, everyone else was playing it and I was just
you're right, it was
else.
At PAX. Yeah. And that was with the whole cars and the mini stars stuff, because the game doesn't mm-hmm. have coins, it's got mini stars, and then whoever yep. gets the most mini stars gets real stars, and it's just like just stop. But I'm a bit surprised. See, I felt like there's definitely a certain amount of FU you can do in this game. But there's always been kind of that in Mario Party. And I feel like that may, it's weird that they made a game that emphasizes that more. Because, I mean, that's when I have the most fun with Mario Party. But I think that's when the sociopaths like myself enjoy Mario Party. I'm kind of surprised they made a game that lets you subject people to it even worse. But I would argue there is a certain amount of randomness, because it felt like the turn order shuffled every turn.
Some of the boards do that. Yeah.
So it's just like, oh God, all right, well, I can't screw anybody because it's probably going to be I end up screwing, which is actually fairly Mario Party-esque.
Sure.
Did you ever play Fortune Street?
Just a little bit.
That is probably the most, like, I can just ruin this game for you whenever I want game in that kind of mold that I've ever seen.
Well, it's not really a party game, though. It's more of a monopoly. So, like, if you end up getting all the resources, you can just be like, yeah, I'm denying you everything. You're going to pay me every time, everywhere you go.
Yeah, it's, well, the whole market thing and how you can invest in spaces, there's all kinds of nonsense you can do. But, yeah, there is something about that. Like, when there's a game where you can, if you can strategize and you're playing with younger kids and the randomness doesn't give them the leg up, because Mario Party almost has to be random, because the skill golf, if you could just set traps like this, the skill golf becomes so immense. It's kind of like it's the same reason why you get good power-ups in Mario Kart if you're in the back. Because right. If everybody got the same power-ups, the players with the high skill ceiling would be so far ahead that it would be boring for everybody. It's frustrating to get blue shelled into oblivion, but it keeps you in the pack. So in the end, you're still having a better race experience than you would otherwise, because you would just win every race by, you know, 35 seconds or whatever.
Sure.
But it obviously is infuriating.
Yeah, well, in Mario Party 9, it's more, I don't know. They don't really blue shell the leader. What happens usually is that at some point Bowser shows up, calls everyone losers, and then makes someone spin a roulette. And the consequence of the roulette that we ended up landing the most often on was kind of a reshuffling of the stars through one mini game. And so if you could win that mini game, you basically got like 50% of the stars accumulated during the game, and everyone else shared, you know, the other 50%. So you were golden, and that happens towards the back end of the game, right? So, yeah, it seemed poorly balanced that way, and that's probably why I just ended up kind of dominating. To be fair, also, I probably should have set up like some sort of handicap at the beginning, which the game lets you do, but why would I do that?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I as I've gotten older and played with more kids, and as a kid, I dominated adults I played video games with because they didn't grow up with them, or they grew up with really primitive games. Hmm. As an adult, I dominate children. It's not like by design.
It's pretty great.
It's just like I've got 30 years of playing video games experience. You play friggin' candy match threes, like you're gonna get housed. We know this is coming. And like I've grown to appreciate the fact that sometimes even if you're a high skill ceiling player, the frustration of randomness pushing the skill floor, pushing your ceiling down, their floor up, making the game more enjoyable as a multiplayer experience, even if it makes the game itself a little bit more like, God damn it. So it's kind of weird to see them make a game where skill actually makes it so you're more likely to win.
Yeah, but you know, as I said, in the end, someone else came in and wiped the floor with me.
There you go.
And I ended up doing worse than second place. Like, so chance still, you know, plays a role. And
okay.
I don't know. It was enjoyable for me. I think the kids also enjoyed it because we did end up playing, you know, four games. So everyone wins.
Fair enough. So, Guillaume, what else did you have to talk about this week?
A theme of this summer really has been, well, the soundtrack of my summer has been provided by Yuzo Koshiro so far. And as it turns out,
does that mean you've been just walking along the street beating people up?
Yeah. No, I mean literal soundtrack.
Did you become God at any point?
No. I didn't, you know, shoot arrows at people in diapers. Literally a lot of the games I've been playing this summer have had his soundtracks. And as it turns out, a new eShop game came out 3 weeks ago, Gutta Protectors, which is kind of the sequel to an XBLA indie game.
I've talked about that game on this show.
Right. Yeah, so this is the sequel. It's on 3DS. And it's by Ancient, which is apparently he and his sister's company. And so not only content to write the soundtrack to every freaking game ever, he has to create more games to compose soundtracks for. So it's actually pretty good. Like it's got this NES kind of style, you know, sprites and stuff. But the characters, it's got a lot of character. It's got a lot of, it's adorable. It is really like the game opens with kind of the cinematic, which is bonkers, which shows you the different classes of heroes. So you've got like the guy with an axe, the Amazon, who's, you know, really not wearing appropriate clothing. And then you've got the ninja who wears even more inappropriate clothing because he's wearing this kind of, he's got a Speedo that somehow has straps that go over his shoulders.
Oh yeah.
To really expose all the legs, you know?
Oh yeah.
And
you are overselling these straps. Like there is much less to them than you are letting on here.
Anyway, so he's very perilously close to being naked, and
he has his crotch in a sling, and that is essentially the entirety of his outfit.
Exactly, yeah. And you know, the episode other titles. Like one of the characters is called Old Guy, and he's basically Don Quixote. So, and he's, you know, like he's got this kind of wooden horse around his waist, like it's just ridiculous. And so the game, the goal of the game, you're bashing enemies, you mash B a lot, and you're trying to protect this princess that's in the middle of the castle, and so the enemies kind of keep coming at you. It's a little bit tower defense-esque, except that you go out there and you go bash the enemies yourself. Like, you can set up barricades, you can install towers that will shoot at the enemies, but mostly you're going to go in there into the fray and you're going to try to destroy all the enemies and destroy all their spawn points. And they might try to complicate things a little bit with, like, more complicated maps with, like, you can go in the water and there might be current, so you've got to be careful or you're going to get washed away and get far away from the castle and might not be able to go back in time to save the princess and stuff like that. And, you know, like, there's keys and locked doors and stuff like that. But it's a very, very simple affair. And I've heard it compared to Musou games, you know, Dynasty Warriors and Hyrule Warriors.
Like an 8-bit DMake of a Musou game?
Yeah, kind of. And yeah, I can see that. It feels very much like that, because at least the initial enemies, usually, like, you kill them in one or two swings of your axe, and you kill, you know, four or five at a time. So it's got very much that feel to it. And
what happens is it's dumb, which is right on point.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was playing that a little bit before my vacation started, and I wasn't feeling it that much, because it's got kind of this grindy element to it. As you destroy enemies, you get coins, you get resources, and then you invest these resources in order to power up your guy, to power up your weapons, to gain new abilities, and things like that. But it's very, you know, like, you might have to collect, like, this many banana bunches to be able to upgrade your, yes, bananas. And
Is Donkey Kong one of your characters?
Look, there's like a whole screen, like, there's maybe, I don't know, 50 items that you can gain, that resources that you can get and use to upgrade your stuff, including, of course, eggplants, candy, and also, like, fangs, like vampire fangs. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
As you did.
But anyway, so you have to collect all this stuff, and it's just, you might have to replay a level over and over again, maybe, to try to grind to get the resources to upgrade your guy to do better in the next level. So, I don't know. Like, I'm not too much of a fan of that, but just before recording, what I did was I played with Karen in co-op, because this game has download play. You can play with, you know, someone else who has the full version, but you also have download play, and that worked well. Like, she was able to select any of the characters, and they all had, like, basically level 4 spells and skills and stuff like that, which is pretty high, actually. So it was appropriate for where I was at in the game, and so she just helped me out, you know, like, kind of sometimes staying behind at the castle, making sure the barricades were okay, and dealing with the enemies around there while I was exploring. And trying to find the enemy spawn points, and you know, and vice versa, and it was a lot of fun. Like, it, just like any, you know, action game, it's always more fun when you're playing co-op. But I really felt that this time, you know, like, when you're by yourself, it's it gets tedious. When you're with someone else, it just how do I describe this? It's just more fun. Like, it's more
everything's
like
more
sharing.
Fun in co-op.
Yeah,
this
well,
is
yeah,
one
that,
of
yeah.
everything.
Yeah, but, you know, like, it's so stupid, and you're sharing the stupidity together. So, you know.
Well, what's funny is, I bet if you went back and listened to me describe Protect Me Night, the Xbox Live indie game, it probably sounds just like this conversation of, like,
yeah.
I mean, it's a really faithful demake of an 8-bit game. Like, it feels like this feels like a game you would have bought on a cartridge from, I don't know, Jellico.
Well, I think that the graphics maybe and the music, but less so the gameplay. I don't recall, like, the closest thing from back in the day that I would compare this to is maybe Gauntlet. And who liked NES Gauntlet? No one.
I would say, God, there's a game that I'm just can't think of where it was a little bit similar to this, but I just mean, like, if this game had existed in, say, 1989, I wouldn't be surprised by it at all. Yeah. But, like, it
looks the part. Yeah,
yeah, and the gameplay cycle is relatively simplistic. I mean, it's got RPG elements, as you mentioned. It's got some base building stuff. So there's things in there beyond that base building,
sure,
in quotes.
But I mean, RPG elements, quote unquote, that's in almost every, like,
yeah,
it's in every mobile game, even, you know,
like it is period faithful, though. Like, you may have, like, now you can buy better spell. And in fact, it's a Super Nintendo game, but it's not super dissimilar from the Goemon game we did. I'm blanking on what its name was.
Oh, Legend of Mystical Ninja was the localized title for the first of the Goemon games on Super Nintendo.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the same, but like that's the depth of your what you're dealing with. At least is what the Xbox One was like.
Well, yeah, like. I don't know. To me, the kind of the grindy aspect of it is very modern. It's very much a kind of time waster kind of game, you know, mobile or otherwise. So yeah, I'm not sure. I don't think that it plays or feels like a Nintendo game, but it sure sounds and looks like one. What else was I?
Well, you could argue it sounds like a Sega game.
Yeah, I suppose so. One funny thing, I didn't look at it but there's an option in the menu for DLC. And
yes.
According to the Player One podcast, the DLC is the FM synth version of the soundtrack.
That is indeed true, yes.
And it costs like $8 more.
Yeah,
on
it's
top
crazy.
Of a $13 game. Yeah.
Well, what's funny is like I think I paid like $2 for the indie game. So when I was excited, then I saw the price and went, "Whoa, what?" To hear that they put $8 FM synth soundtrack DLC, like that really goes back to what we were talking about a couple weeks ago with the why would you buy a physical copy of a digital game you probably already own? It's like, well, I'm just a fan. I'm going to support this,
right? But like the game is already kind of expensive for what it is, in my opinion. So
oh, yeah.
I'm just like, really? Like, why is there a reason why the soundtrack is not FM synth to begin with? And yeah, I guess it's just, you know, like it's the game company of a composer. So, yeah, sure. And, you know, like he probably knows that he can sell his like the better version of his soundtrack on there for a high price. So
this anyway, week's end music is the FM synth version, which we got on YouTube. No, I'm joking. We're not doing that this week. We'll do that a few weeks just to make a point.
Yeah, but yeah, it's a cute game. Like it doesn't take itself seriously. The story actually made me chuckle a few times. Like it's well localized, and you know sometimes stuff like Dragon Fantasy did not make me really crack a smile because it was just like, hey, look, this trope, haha. And but in this case, like they actually write jokes and you know like that have punchline. It's actually well made, and the enemies, you know, you've got your assortment of goblins and stuff like that, like skeletons, but you've also got like little girls in bear costumes throwing bombs. So
oh my god, I just stumbled across the actual website for it on ancient.co.jp. Their mm-hmm. Gacha Protectors is of course the Western name for it. I think it's still Protect Me Night 2 in Japan,
right.
And the anime art for the characters is very like early 90s, late 80s anime art with that particular style. But mm-hmm. on the Western page, they have like the hauntingly drawn Western art that you might see on a localized cover of this game on the NES.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, at all times wow. On the bottom screen, you get the manual for the game. And yeah, you got the cover page, which is very much, what's his name? That guy who's on, you know, on the cover of every romance novel.
Oh yeah, I know what you're talking
Fabio.
About
Fabio. Yeah, so yeah. Yeah, it's very Fabio like.
Oh
yeah.
Wow, this website almost makes it worth it. Anyway, speaking of almost makes it worth it. It's time for mm-hmm. my segment, which, so we received it's not a review copy because we're doing it. We don't do reviews on RFN, but we received a code for Tadpole Treble. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one. So if you have been if you haven't heard of this game, it's kind of a rhythm game. I'm a little reticent to call it that, although everybody else seems more than happy to. It's kind of became semi well known because the art was done by the guy who does the comic Brawl in the Family, and the music was composed by somebody who I can't remember who it is now. But basically,
well, isn't the music, I don't know, like, isn't it kind of public domain kind of stuff?
No, Like there's, it's got lyrics and stuff that speak to the actions taking place on screen.
Well, it might also be Matthew Taranto, because he did quite a few musicals on Brawl in the Family. Like he's got musical skills.
Oh, okay. And that may be the case then. So what this game is essentially you play as a tadpole who is trying to get back to its home. And you swim through stages that just happen to be shaped like a staff of a music notation. And, you avoid things on the staff that also happen to just coincidentally represent the music that is playing in the background. There are occasionally, like, there are pickups you get throughout the stage where you have to be on that spot in the staff to pick them up. And then there are some spots where you press A to interact with stuff that may or may not require you to be on a specific spot on the staff. But the primary gameplay hook to clear a stage is to not get hit. It's a little bit like, to think of a good example, as it scrolls sideways, you're just trying to avoid getting hit by stuff. There's a decent number of games that kind of fall on that.
The bike stage and Battletoads.
Done. There. Yes. But it's dots, and there's lots of them, and they'll do chains and stuff, and because it's the notation of the music, or at least the notation of the primary melody of the music. So it's not, you know, it's not just like, here's a gap, pass through it, here's a gap, pass through it. And essentially it's like 12 stages of that, so you pass through the stage, and there's a couple times where the game sort of does something different, like the final boss is a fairly different experience. But that's basically the primary gameplay premise. Sometimes there are hazards, and you have to hit a button at the right time to cause the hazard to get pushed back, and et cetera, et cetera. The art is very stylistic. I think it's actually a little washed out, personally, but I understand it's a style choice. Otherwise, it looks fine. The music is you know, it's very well put together. It's very thematically appropriate. Sometimes they'll play with the theme of a stage and change the art style and the music to match. I think that's very, you know, a very nicely done element of the game. When the song's got lyrics, the mixing can be a little eh, but generally speaking, I can hear it well, and they're kind of amusingly describing what's going on, maybe a little too on the nose. The problem I've got is, I mean, it's not a problem for me. This game's getting really good reviews, and maybe I'm just missing something. But I was bored out of my mind playing this game. And here's the reason, and it really comes down to one fundamental thing, and this is why I cannot call this a rhythm game, is that your action on screen has almost nothing to do with the music. And here's what I mean. So the staff that you're swimming on is covered in the notes of the music, and a lot of times it's just the primary melody, sometimes even the accompaniment's on there, so there's lots of dots that you can't hit, lots of stage hazards. But you're not moving to where the music is. You're moving away from it. And that's such a disconnect for me. Like, there's a real dissonance there, because the music is saying it's going on arpeggio up. In any other rhythm game, that would be telling me I need to do the same. I need to replicate what's happening. And you know, there's a broad swath of what falls in the rhythm game category. You have things like Rhythm Heaven, where you are actively contributing to the music, but primarily just because you're going on the beats or where they want you to be. Unless it's not Flipside, the one that has you go off the beat, that's miserable and I hate it.
Lockstep. Lockstep,
yeah. Yeah,
from the DS game.
Yeah, the blight on society that is Lockstep.
It's not that hard.
It's not. It's just awful. It's not hard. It's just awful.
I liked it, but...
Well, that's because you've got problems. but the closest parallel that I could think of in recent memory of a game that's like really going to cue you to the music and with a handful of button presses is really what they do in the last Rayman game. Not Legacy, not
Legends.
Was Legends the first or the second one? The Wii U one.
It's the second one.
There's that stage where they put music and
there was a few of them, weren't there? A few different ones.
Or you have stuff like Bit Trip games and stuff. Where those are all rhythm games at some degree, but this just doesn't feel like it, because ultimately, you can mute this game, completely mute the game, and the loss of the music doesn't really hurt you, because the game is still avoid the notes. At this point, you just lose the artifice of, oh, these are the notes that are going with this music. And to be a good rhythm game, at least to me, the music has to be a character in the game, and not just a character in the dressing of the game, but like a core part of the gameplay. Even games that I may have said aren't good rhythm games, like Rhythm Thief, which I think is a good game. I don't know that it's a good rhythm game. Still make sure the music is integral to the gameplay itself. And by divorcing the gameplay from what's actually happening in the music, or at least abstracting it enough that your goal is to not be there versus to be there, I think it actually detracts from the game as a whole, which is upsetting because the mechanics work well enough. I think it's a little dry, just avoiding the things on the screen. And the presentation is largely there, even if I don't necessarily like it personally. I recognize the quality of it is there and the work. But to have this disconnect is so jarring from what you would expect out of a rhythm game that I found it kind of dull. And because it is essentially saying, don't be where the notes are. If the songs go to an extended period where they kind of get into a rhythm and they're not moving all up and down the staff, you can kind of go to a place in the screen and just sit there. And there were sequences where like the song was down in the low part of the staff, like down in like the EF area on the staff, because it's all treble, hence the name. Like I could go up to the top of the staff and just sit there at like the E on the second or the first gap and just sit there and do nothing. And I mean, I might be missing some of the optional pickups, and that's what you score you want at the end of the stage, and you unlock some stuff through that. But to clear the stage, there were extended sequences where I could just go like, all right, just watch the tadpole, just swim along, and then occasionally I had to go back and do stuff. And those weren't common, but they should, in a rhythm game, they shouldn't exist at all. They just shouldn't be there. And so to me, this isn't a rhythm game. This is essentially a kind of an old quarter muncher game. Avoid stuff coming at you. It just happens to have a high layer of music and artistry behind it. It's like, oh, what's that? What are those Don Bluth games?
Dragon's Lair.
Yeah, is Dragon's Lair a Gauntlet style game? No, it has a lot of the artifice that you would expect, but it to a really good degree. But ultimately, it is a know when to press button or give me more quarters game. I'm not saying this is like that, but just because it has those trappings doesn't make it a rhythm game. And there's people who are going to go like, well, you have to know where to go by the music, but you don't, because I tried it. I muted the game. I turned off the volume on the gamepad and played it and got a score roughly comparable to what I got when I had played that stage earlier with the music.
Yeah, so it's like the level layouts are derived from the music to some extent, right? But that isn't necessarily an unambiguously great thing because of the issue you talked about where it kind of gives you an area, a layout where you can just kind of stay safe in one sector for a good long while. And then if it's not particularly connecting you to the music either, then I guess you say, well, what is the upside of it being derived from the music?
Right. Especially so with...
It's as if you had like a shoot 'em up where there was a corner where your ship would never get hit, and you wouldn't get the points, but you also would clear the levels that way.
And that doesn't happen that often. Like there's three. I played through the whole game in one sitting because it's like 12 levels. There is one stage in particular where it happens an egregious number of times, but in general it's pretty rare. But it's just a symptom of what I'm talking about. It is a consequence of the hook being don't be where the music is versus be where the music is. And I understand why they did it, because a lot of the music is relatively complicated and there's lots of note patterns going on and they're represented on the staff. And there's that whole law of physics about being in multiple places in one time. But it doesn't even award you by being close to the notes. Like, if it gave you more points for the closer you hung to where the dangerous stuff was, like Crazy Taxi style, where the closer you missed the oncoming traffic, the more money you got, and the more righteous dude you were told you were by the guy in the back. If it did that, I think that would be a benefit. But really, it just increases points based on how many notes you've missed, which is really funny when you get into a period where there's just no notes on this one spot, the staff, and you can just leave it. So I know why this game is getting good reviews. It kills it at the presentation layer. It really does. But I just found it, the gameplay, to be so shallow. Like, I like that they put a level editor in there where you can make your own music by making a level. That's cool. It's probably going to sound like garbage unless you're good at making music. Just as a consequence of that. But it's, I just don't feel it. I don't feel it. And it's a bummer. And I appreciate some people like this game. This game is, as someone who loves rhythm games, this game is decidedly not for me. And, like I said, it's a shame. I will speak very briefly about Mystery Game, because I've been teasing Mystery Game for a little bit. I finished Tokyo Mirage Session Sharp FE Gene Ibn Roku Edition, over the Mar break, the week we took off, and, I had another game kind of sitting in the wing. And that game is the 15-year-old PlayStation 2 RPG Dot Hack Volume 1 Infection. And the question of why I am playing this episodic JRPG that no one can get the fourth copy of if you care about, or the fourth chapter of, because it's super expensive, is again an issue of music, which is why I'm going to mention it here. Because as I was researching music to send TYP another missive of songs that he could include in Radio Trivia episodes, that came up as a recommended. And I remembered, like, having affection for the elements of the transmedia property that was the Dot Hack project when Bandai Namco thought they could be, or Bandai at that point, I don't think they had merged yet, could out-level 5 before level 5 even existed. With this Dreamcast graphics on a PS2 launch game, or near launch game, and like a TV show and comics and everything. And I'm not very far into it, like only 4 hours in, and it's not very long because they're episodic, which is also a great way to make a JRPG short and still get full price for it. It's kind of, all of this is ingenious, but I want to talk transmedia property when John's here, because that's his favorite topic. I will say the idea of it's a game set in an MMO, although it's not really an MMO, because it's a PS2 game. And they do a lot of stuff that makes it kind of feel right, because you're trying to unravel a mystery in the game about the game. And as opposed to just leading you from story place to story place like most JRPGs, you're kind of having to comb through the game's fake message boards, which is outside of the game that is in the game. Like, so you start the game by going to your computer and logging into the game that is inside the game, which is the core gameplay of the game, or checking your emails on your computer, which is outside of the game, or getting communications inside of the game. Like, there's this weird meta-ness to it that I actually really enjoy, and it actually gives them sort of adventure-style things. Like, you'll be reading message board posts, and you'll see stuff, and you'll go, I should look into that. And then you'll go back into the game and look into it, and that's where, like, a story sequence will happen, versus just like, hey, go here and do this thing. I appreciate that. But this game is going to be really hard to talk about, so I'm going to save it for when John's here, and we can talk about transmedia properties or polymorphic content instead. But
nice.
I'm enjoying it. So if you're in the market for a 15-year-old PlayStation 2 JRPG that you'll never be able to finish because the fourth chapter costs, like, $150, and largely speaking is almost looks like a Dreamcast game, and where you can watch NPC run, you can watch AI controlled NPCs run around pretending to be human controlled non-NPCs interacting with AI controlled NPCs that are AI controlled by AI controlled, and you just want to have your head wrecked by meta-ness. Dot Hack Volume 1 Infection, I guess. What am I doing with my life? Greg.
Yep.
Save me from this.
Well, yeah, so past couple of weeks, I've played a little of a lot of different stuff, which is not ideal for a coherent new business segment, but,
you've seen how we failed so far. That's right. Even with, like, well-defined games.
Greg, do you have any 25-year-old meta adventure games you could talk about?
No, nothing quite that
Sam
old.
Sam and Max, format your C drive.
There's some old stuff coming in this bit. But first of all, a quick mention of the fact that as we record this, we're like under 2 hours away from the embargo coming down for Federation Force reviews. And I just, you know, so basically, to be clear, because it's not coming out for another couple of weeks here, the embargo is is at the same time as the game becomes downloadable for everyone, right? In America, mm-hmm. that's at midnight Eastern.
Yes.
Yeah, which is not common, right?
I mean, not for Nintendo, no. And what's even crazier about this, because this episode will come out after the embargo is out, and I can say this, is that I have read NWR's review of this, and it is glowing, and it's mm-hmm. and it's not from somebody who it's not from somebody who I would just say like it's going to give this game like 10 just because it's Metroid, and you know I have heard from people who have this game as review copies and in other outlets. And they're like, it's good. And I don't understand why Nintendo buried this game now.
No, it seems like some weird, like, not so much a self-fulfilling prophecy, but like, you know, like a prophecy fulfilled by coercion of other people.
You want us to cancel the game, so we pretended like we did.
Yeah, it's a strange one. I have no, maybe, you know, if you know all the reasons behind it, it's perfectly understandable, but it just seems like they're almost going to play into the perception that it's some sort of dog, when, you know, I'd be very surprised if it was. And, you know, it certainly doesn't sound like it is, to be honest, because there have been, you know, some impressions articles that were allowed as well, just talking right. about really, really early stuff that I've read as well. So, yeah, I think it's been weird the run up to this game.
I will say there is a comment in one of the NWR email review threads where somebody is basically screaming for the rest of the staff to quote talk down my score, please. Like there is a sense that this is a really good game that may get missed.
Maybe so. But, I've got a couple of weeks to digest all the reviews or whatever, see if I want it and whatnot. But I'm interested. Yeah, you know, and I've enjoyed Blast Ball. And one last night on Blast Ball, quite a lot of Japanese people playing that game. Interestingly, wouldn't necessarily have thought that. Given that, all right, it's kind of a weird kind of soccer game, but it's first person and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know whether that'll sort of manifest itself in the final game at all. It might be weirdly popular in Japan where there isn't so much consternation about all this
maybe
stuff.
They'll just market it as Blast Ball also featuring Metroid Prime Federation Force. That would be amazing.
In terms of stuff I've been doing, Pokemon Snap came out here today. It was fairly predictable that Pokemon Virtual Console games are going to get expedited in yes. the current Pokemania.
Can we talk about this real quick?
I have barely touched it yet, but I did want to say that I've never played it before. I'm getting it now. That'll probably be something I'll talk about next week or something, because it's not apparently very long. It's the kind of thing I've been thinking about doing for a long time, and this is the excuse.
I mean, can we talk about the Pokemania real quick?
Oh, okay, right, yeah, sure.
So in the US, July sales of Pokemon Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire for the Nintendo 3DS were over 80% higher than July 2015, so the year before. The games launched in November 2014. Pokemon X and Y were 200% higher than a year ago. The games launched in October 2013. And finished number 16 and number 22 on the July's bestseller list, respectively.
And of course, there's the fact that your 3DS as hardware finished on
80% top. More than they sold last July.
Yeah, there was a 2DS price cut as well, which yes. kind of probably helped a bit. And Monster Hunter was top.
Number one selling game.
Yeah, Monster Hunter Generations of War. That is actually what I've got for new business here, Monster Hunter Generations.
Oh, see? Look at that transition. It's almost I knew.
Yeah, I haven't got much to say about this yet other than basically I have played a bit of Monster Hunter before. If people have got long memories, I had a try on Wii and I spoke about it on the show and whatnot. But, I mean, I probably played that for about 25, 30 hours, something like that, you know, which is quite a lot of time for some games, but it's not very far down the Monster Hunter rabbit hole. You know, like I enjoyed it to an extent, but I couldn't get fully locked into the cycle that you know people do with Monster Hunter and end up spending many, many more hours than that on. But you know, all these years later, you know, Generations kind of interested me because you know, supposedly have a bit more of an action focus and some of the other kind of improvements that they've made, cleaning things up and having a bunch of content from a lot of different games, you know, giving it variety and whatnot. Having not played 4 on 3DS myself or anything other than Tri in the series at all. So, yeah, I got it about a week ago, and so far I said I'm not far enough in to really render any kind of significant kind of verdict or anything, but it's promising for in terms of getting deeper into it than I did before, because first of all, the fact that you can now play as the feline sort of companions, the prowler mode, as they call it, they are very good for doing all the gathering kind of, you know, splitting the sort of hunting and the gathering, because they don't have any of the sort of restrictions that your normal hunter does in terms of they don't have a stamina meter. That you see, you could just run all over the place gathering stuff, you know, going from point A to point B on the map, whatever you need to do, without, you know, having to think about, you know, eating rations or, you know, having to worry about hot or cold climates or, you know, having to think about your bug net, you know, wearing out or your pickaxe wearing out or any of that stuff. It's just all very simple. You know, you run to the spot your whole day until it's exhausted. That's it. So that's kind of cool. And they are, you know, cute and amusing characters. Currently, my feline is running around with a rolled up newspaper, beating up monsters. So, you know, it just,
as you do,
it just kind of spice. And of course, there's all the costume DLC stuff that they're doing. Yeah, you know, Okami, Wind Waker, Ghosts and Goblins, and Striders.
Look at all these games we don't make anymore.
Yeah, it's kind of sad in a way. But,
it's the fuck you customers parade from Capcom. It comes with every Monster Hunter game.
But, you know, it's a cute little way of kind of making the gathering stuff a little bit more palatable for me. And also the fact that it's portable is a big deal in that regard. You know, we talk about kind of off TV play or portable games where there's certain aspects you can kind of do while doing other stuff, you know, sort of paying scant attention to the actual game itself, you know, watching a ball game, whatever it might be. And this sort of, you know, these sorts of quests where you might be killing lesser animals, you know, for drops or, you know, gathering material, stuff like that. They're pretty, that's kind of, you know, suitable for that kind of, if you're looking to kind of do two things at once, you know, that kind of thing. It's pretty good. It's pretty good for that. Whereas, you know, when I was playing Tri, it, you know, I had to be there in front of the team. That was going to be the focus. And I think, because that thing is, you know, conceptually, I really like the idea of these huge boss battles with these very sort of carefully designed creatures that have, you know, very specific kind of behavior patterns and everything. You know, that's all kind of the thing, you know, the sort of thing that I like about games oftentimes. But the way it's kind of all dressed up and, you know, the gear grind and all that is a tough, as, you know, was always like the tough part of the sell for me. And I just think a lot of that is going to be more doable, with this game, you know, both the portable nature and it and the changes they've made with using the Prowler. So, no, I'm optimistic about getting deeper into this, but, long way to go yet. So I probably won't talk about it for a while, but it looks good so far. The last thing I'll talk about is, I finally finished off my playthrough of Banjo-Tooie this week, which I started doing. Remember, I got my Xbox One sort of about October last year and started doing Rare Replay pretty soon. I spoke about Blast Corps and Jet Force Gemini, playing those a lot. And, you know, pretty much after those, you know, after what I talked about those on the show, like Banjo-Tooie was like the next thing I moved on to. And now here we are, you know, nearly 10 months or whatever it is, and I finally did get around to finish it. I mean, it is a big game, you know, it's fairly long, but it's not that big. It's just I've done it really super gradually, because the Xbox is not the most convenient system to play compared to Wii U and 3DS. But also, there's just aspects of Banjo-Tooie that kind of make it difficult to nibble away at over like an extended period where you might take big breaks, because unlike something like Mario 64, which I replayed through on the Wii U virtual console, you know, Mario 64 is pretty clear about, you know, what you're meant to be doing to get a star. You know, the worlds are remixed when you go back in.
Right.
You know, for that specific star challenge, and you know, it has a title and all that kind of stuff. So it's very much just kind of pick up a play, you know, go get in there, have fun, explore, get a star. All right, I'll come back to it another time. Now, obviously, you know, 2E, like Banjo-Kazooie as well, you know, is about collected jiggies. You know, it's not on the surface of it that different, but because you don't have that, you know, the whole aspect of the worlds having to be sort of remixed for each one or anything like that, that it's a lot more open ended about what you sort of can do to get a jiggy at any particular point. And it's, the thing is that you've got so many different sort of aspects of the game in terms of all the different abilities that Banjo-Kazooie learn, both together and separately. And then you've got things like the transformations, bringing Mumbo into the mix. You've got this thread of the train that runs through a bunch of the different worlds that you have to sort of open up so that you could transport stuff from one world to another and all that. And the thing is, when you take a break from this game, and come back to it, you know, maybe, you know, several weeks later or something, you will forget what you've kind of, you know, what sort of parts of a particular quest line you have or haven't done. So it's a lot more difficult for sort of progress to pay off in a jiggy than it would be if you, like when I played it back when I had it on N64 originally, where I just, you know, marathoned it pretty much. You know, I played it about as fast as I possibly could. You know, so all that information was fresh in my head and it kind of flowed together. This, you have a lot more time kind of spent picking up the threads of where you were on certain objectives, and that kind of bogged me down and stuff. So it's one of these seasons. I mean, looking at it now, you know, the scale of Banjo-Tooie is still kind of somewhat remarkable. You know, they really did make these really huge worlds, you know, compared to the first one, or certainly compared to Mario 64. But obviously, that isn't as impressive as it was back then. And so, you know, what sticks out more is the sort of the bloat of it. You know, it seems like it's more about the game's ambition rather than making a sort of lean, mean gameplay experience. But, you know, I still enjoyed it in many respects. But it just, it does kind of feel like they were reaching towards a different kind of game. And it's a bit of a sort of unhappy medium between like the original Banjo, which was a bit more focused, you know, and then maybe some sort of larger 3D exploration kind of action adventure. You know, it seems like it's really kind of not content to be a platformer at this point, you know, and so much of it isn't about platforming. But I mean, one thing I was thinking about actually, because the Gamescom is, you know, there's some footage now of Yooka-Laylee, you know, people playing it and stuff, I was looking at, and there's a few encouraging things for me about Yooka-Laylee that, you know, maybe they're gonna kind of avoid, you know, maybe making some of the missteps of it that Tui made, which is, first of all, the movement speed of the character. Just if you just watch any sort of gameplay footage, is clearly much more pleasant. You know, it's so much quicker. It kind of feels like Banjo is, you know, he's kind of walking around at roughly, I guess, the same speed that he was in the first one, but the worlds are way bigger, so it's just not balanced right anymore. And you know, you will always want to be running around with Kazooie, sort of do it, you know, when you do that move where Kazooie kind of puts Banjo on her back. You do that all the time, which is kind of, anytime you do that kind of technique all the time, it's kind of like when people rolling around with Link all the time, whatever. It's like, yeah, this probably shouldn't be the way it is if you want to be doing something like that. constantly to try and speed up the traversal. And so that's the thing, you know, with ukulele, the character movement seems really fast. When you do the actual dash, it's super, super fast. So that looks really encouraging. And then the other thing is structurally, they've got this idea of like when you collect pages, as the jiggy stand-ins are called in ukulele, you actually have the option to like expand a world. So, you know, basically it starts off smaller. And then, you know, if you want to sort of, use them to open up that world and then find more stuff in it, you can do that. That's the thing with these Banjo-Tooie world, you know, you don't have to collect all the jiggies to finish the game, although it's a much higher percentage than it is in the case of something like Mario 64.
Right.
If you want to fight the final boss, which is, it's a good final boss, but it's got some teeth to it. But the point is that you will inevitably go in, the worlds are still going to be the same size. You know, you're still thrown into these absolutely enormous levels. Some of them really quite complicated. You know, even if, you know, you might think, oh, well, I only really need to get, you know, six of the jiggies in this world or something. Whereas in this, you know, it's got to be, well, you know, the world will start off at a sort of more manageable size and then you can expand it if you want to get everything. I think that's an interesting compromise. Obviously, you know, we don't really know exactly how it's going to work in practice, but it's an intriguing notion. So, you know, whatever problems I had, some of them sort of self-created with my playthrough of 2E, it's got me, you know, enthused and in anticipation of ukulele when that's supposedly going to get here in the first quarter of next year.
Oof. That game has been on my radar so long, I occasionally forget about it, so I appreciate the reminder. They actually released a Gamescom trailer yesterday, I think?
Mm-hmm.
That I haven't watched yet because I keep forgetting about it. But that's okay. Everything's okay. It's coming, and we'll have to collect. I can't remember what they're calling them. They're not calling them jiggies.
They're the pages.
Pages. Yeah. You're right. Yes. God bless them. But hopefully they seem to recognize they learned the lesson, because you're right. It is a much, much higher percentage than it is puzzle pieces versus stars.
Yeah, you saw it's actually 70 in each case, but of course you're talking about 70 out of 120 in Mario, whereas 70 out of 90 in Banjo-Tooie. So yeah, you know, you do have to drill pretty deep down into these huge worlds to be able to fight the final boss. Although you can see the credits with just 55, so that's nice.
If that's your goal is to see the credits.
I've seen the credits, you know, screw the last boss, who cares about that?
I'm sure it'll end fine.
They definitely, you know, they make that joke in the narrative, like, you know, because that's just, do the quiz show sort of thing that was the only way a Banjo game could ever end. But yeah, for some reason, you know, they have that sort of false ending, and then you have to get another 15 jiggies to actually do the last boss.
Yeah, the quiz show is one of my favorite endings to a game. It's not really the ending, but there is a certain degree of like, if they end ukulele with the quiz show, I'm done.
Oh, like, they've got to. I'm telling you, that has got to happen. There is no way that isn't going to happen.
You can't go back to that well again.
Oh, they can and they will. Even in the Banjo-Tooie final battle, the quiz questions actually make their way into the battle part as well.
Oh.
You know, so I think if this trajectory continues...
And they're in Nuts and Bolts too. That's
no, other, yeah, I still haven't played that. Obviously, I've got it as part of Rare Replay, but I haven't played it yet.
Oh, good grief. That game. All right. That's going to do it for new business this week. When we come back, it'll be time for your listener mail. So stay tuned, because I know we put on such a good face this segment. And we're back. It's time for listener mail. You can email us, like these people did, at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That's where you can send us your questions, comments, concerns, life stories, dinner invitations, whatever. You could just send it to us. You could send us your 45 gigabyte attachments of fan art. I don't care. Just send it. We'll read your fan comics on the show. Like this one. Guillaume.
David from California writes, "Hello, gentlemen. I have been playing Rhythm Heaven Mega Mix for a month and a half. This was my first Rhythm Heaven game, and I love it. The music is so infectious. As I'm trying to get perfect on every single game, I'm wondering what the future of this niche Nintendo franchise holds. How can they top this mega collection? Could they, dare I say it, add licensed music to the type of quirky plots these minigames possess? Thanks, and keep up the good work."
Well, if they could just get somebody popular to endorse these games in a multi-million-dollar advertising campaign that makes no sense, I really think that would be the moment where this series just breaks out into the mainstream.
Hmm.
For David's benefit, because he might not know this, for the DS game, Rhythm, which was just Rhythm Heaven in the U.S., Nintendo had no less than Beyonce endorse this game with a commercial of just her lying on a sofa playing this game, laughing. Was it Monkey Watch? No, Monkey Watch was
Monkey
Wii.
Watch is from the next game.
Yeah, one of the Monkey games.
That like, narrows it down.
Yeah, I know. I don't remember which one, okay? The commercial's like 10 years old at this point. But like, it was kind of amazing that it happened in the moment, because you're just sitting there thinking, why?
It's kind of Apex Nintendo... It prints money GIFs, you know.
Right, yeah.
I know they're making a comeback with Pokemon Go, but yeah, this was the vintage days of that.
Because it's such a crazy expense, if you think about it. Like, how much it would have cost to hire Beyonce to record an ad for your freaking rhythm DS. The most Japanese rhythm game you could possibly have.
It's like they thought they maybe could, you know, have some sort of, you know, mainstream hit on their hands like the other, because it was in the Touch Generations branding, right? So you were talking about, you know, Brain Training.
Dr. Kawashima's Brain Training and Brain Age.
Big Brain Academy, you know, that kind of stuff. So
Let me show you my Big Brain Academy.
Yeah, that's what they were hoping for. And then obviously, yeah, that didn't happen. And then subsequently, the games have come, you know, thankfully still come out, but much lower profile, you know, in terms of the marketing and stuff, like budget price for the Wii game in the States, and then digital only for this one in the States. It is getting a retail release in Europe later in the year. But, you know, as to this question, there is a question, you know, seriously about the future of the series to some extent, because, the primary sort of songsmith for the Rhythm Tengoku series, Sunku, as he's known in Japan, has been through quite a lot in recent years, including throat cancer.
Yep.
So, you know, it's kind of...
As a singer is a big deal.
Yeah, well, did he have to have his larynx removed or something? I forget. Oh.
I know the Iwata asks he did, unfortunately, right before Mr. Iwata's passing, for this game, because this game came out in Japan quite a while ago, was all done via email because he couldn't talk.
Yeah, so I mean, he obviously he'd been through, you know, it's doesn't necessarily prevent him from doing the sort of work that, you know, he's been doing on this series. But I mean, I wonder how much that played a part in this game being a, you know, mega mix, as opposed, you know, not having as many original games, or maybe it's nothing to do with it. I have no idea, but it certainly does kind of raise the question about, you know, where would you go from here? You know, is there anywhere you can go after this? I don't know. It's tough, but personally, I'm not all that in favor of the notion of having different music at all. I just think the personality of the games, the aesthetic of the games, and the style of Sunku's music are all inextricably linked to me. And, you know, I mean, if you want to do a licensed music thing or whatever, I'd say bring back EBA/Awendam. You know, that's the kind of thing I'm quite happy to see. You know, we talked about those games where James was playing the second Japanese one a while ago. I would love to see those come back. I think, you know, that they do a nice job of kind of working in these sort of quirky scenarios with songs that you already know, in some cases, perhaps, or songs you don't, if you're playing a Wendon. That's where, if there was going to be licensed music, you know, I think, that would be the decision to make. Rhythm Heaven, I just feel like it's all about personality, and it's got such a strong personality. I'd find it hard to accept tinkering with it, but I guess the question becomes, like, is that better than Oblivion for the series?
Well, I would say that, you know, you say it, the music of this game, it's Sun Ku's voice, even in this, pun not intended, even in this game, you know, his daughter sings one of the songs in this
one
game.
One of the remixes, yeah.
Yeah.
In English.
In English. Yeah, even, they actually made a music video for it too, like, it's crazy. But he's also a decently big celebrity in Japan. He produces a lot of music acts, he does a lot of appearances. You know, he appears in a lot of those.
That's the thing. Like, I mean, we talked about this, you know, in terms of like struggling to crack the West and all that, but he's always been a pretty strong seller in Japan.
Right. He is a celebrity in Japan.
And like, the fact is, yeah, that he has a lot to do with that. So again, I struggle to see how Nintendo would try and kind of reposition the series, you know, away without him, you know, without his stamp on it. It just again, they just seem like joined at the hip to me.
I mean, he was the composer, but he also supervised the development of these games. But his music and Ko Takeuchi's, you know, art design, who's the art designer for the series, are so core to what this series is that, like, they may not design the game, like the individual gameplay stuff, like they may not be the ones responsible for Fruits Basket, which is just lunacy. It's a floor that's alive and it hits fruit into basketball hoops and occasionally dreams about real random bullshit.
I love the dream. It's excellent. I love that.
And it is random. Like, it's not the same every time. They wrote alternate dreams. But those, like, I wouldn't want to see that song done by anybody else or that floor's smug grin drawn by anybody else. So, like, it's so core to what that series is that I wouldn't want to see them go and make a license game, because I talked about this a little bit with Owen Don too, is that it felt like in the case of EBA, they picked music that was A, cheap, and B, because there's a lot of like weird disco and stuff in there, and B was like recognizable enough. And so sometimes that meant you ended up with music that wasn't super great for the kind of game it was.
They weren't equally successful. As we spoke about then, you know, like sometimes when it really comes together, like the Jumpin' Jack Flash finale, like it can work. I think you could do it and do a good job, and that's what I would prefer if you want to do a licensed music rhythm.
I just worry more that they couldn't. That they would, you know, feel compelled to go, okay, we need to have a song that's cross-generationally recognizable. Have we used YMCA in one of these things? I bet that's cheap. And it's like, well, yes, you can do that, but it doesn't work out as well. I thought that in Owen Don, and especially Owen Don 2, the music choice was much better for what they were trying to accomplish. Like,
yeah,
I think verve.
They could do it if they just have the right priorities and realistic aims. Like we said, there's probably that DS period, you know, because it was so successful and stuff. I think sometimes they probably did get a bit sort of too big for their boots in terms of how big they thought a particular game might get. But I guess, you know, when Nintendogs and Brain Trainings blow up the way they do, they didn't really know
sold
what
400
might blow
million
up next,
units.
You know,
like what is the line? Where does this train stop?
But I mean, to make an analogy that will probably draw the ire of James, I think there's a little bit of similarity between Rhythm Heaven and Sun Ku and Earthbound and Itoi in terms of, you know, you could
we'll
make
get to
an
that. That's we'll get to that.
You could make an Earthbound game without Itoi, hypothetically, but I don't think Nintendo ever would. Because that is what the, you know, to them, I think, you know, his style, his writing, you know, his personality that he puts into those games is inextricably linked with the game itself, even though, like, mechanically, you could just sort of abstract it and try and write something, you know, in the spirit of Earthbound. You know, you could try that, but I don't think they would do that anyway, and I don't think they would try and make a Rhythm Heaven without Sunku either.
I'm going to say save it for another part of the show, because it's going to come up in another email. I would say that, what does the future hold for this? Well, I would say your present should hold tracking down a copy of the Wii game. Because to me, that is the pinnacle of the franchise.
How'd they put that on the download, even though it's not difficult to get or anything, but, you know, it's like, it was right. Cheap originally, but it would be not, you know, just it's the convenience, really, of just having it digital.
I think that game is, you probably don't want to play it right now, because you've been playing this game for a month and a half, but that's the hook on your first Rhythm Heaven. Like, that's the one where it sinks in. You go, oh no, this is becoming a problem.
I do still think they could, you know, that is to date the only console one. Right. And I do think it did some, yeah, you know, it did have a bit of multiplayer. It did, you know, having the sort of screen made it better for spectators to kind of take in the weird synthesis that's going on with Rhythm Heaven in terms of sounds and music and wackiness and the visuals, the rhythm, and everything. I kind of feel like, you know, if anything, maybe I guess, you know, we're back to the old chestnut of what the NX is and all that stuff, but, you know, like, maybe a console game, or at least a game that can be played like a traditional console game, is where you could kind of do something with it again, maybe a more robust multiplayer component or that kind of stuff. But I still think it's contingent on Sunku being able to take part myself. I just don't see it without him.
I mean, I'm hope, you know, obviously we hope he gets better. It would be, if he were to, you know, be able to make another one of these games, it would be fantastic, because they're really, really good. And I mentioned it when we talked about it on the show, like, to me, the biggest downers on Megamix were they kind of padded it with too much story stuff, because it's insipid, yes, because it's a Rhythm Heaven story. It should be insipid, but it was, you know, too drawn out. And not necessary. And just so many songs I've seen before. Because a part of the delight of one of these games is that learning it for the first time. Like, that first time you experience Ringside is something unbelievable. Because somebody once described that as the best depiction of professional wrestling that's ever happened in a game. Because you start it, and they're practicing what he's going to say during the interview. Like, that's the opening of that game. The opening of that game is the wrestler and the interviewer practicing what he's going to say and when she's going to prompt him to say things. Like, there's a weird amount of subversiveness in that particular game. And it's kind of like, there is something about experiencing a Rhythm Heaven game for the first time. And really getting in there and drilling through that game and getting really, really good at it. That, you know, in Megamix, I was able to go through and just waste a lot of these games because I know how to play this game. Because like you, I had my 2.5 months with Rhythm Heaven, is it Fever? Fever.
Yes.
On Wii. And like, that I remember 50 to 60 tries of trying to just get perfect for me. Just for me, so I knew I did it Remix 10.
The final remixes are always, because they're always so long, you know, they're the big grand medley style.
Remix 10 is like 5.5 minutes.
It's there is a hell of a lot of inputs in there, which if you get one of them wrong enough, you're out of the game. So yeah, that's always the pinnacle. For me, the tension, my God. And there's one bit of it that you know you're weak on.
Oh, yeah. And it's coming.
And you know it's coming. And it's like, oh, I've got this for. And then when you clear that bit, and it's like, well, now all I have to do is just not fuck up the rest of it.
You immediately fuck up afterwards.
it's unlike, you know, it's a great feeling when you. That is genuine. Fist pump, you know.
I got all the way. I got all the way to the close. So Remix 10 of Fever is Spider Free Candy, which is a terrible name for your candy company with that many spiders around. And that's a super easy game. Like, that game is so easy. Cause it telegraphs everything. It gives you time to think about it. I got all the way to when it closes out that segment and fucked up the bill at the end. So the last thing I do is they throw you a bill, you catch it in the box, and then it zooms into your crazy looking character. End of remix. And I fucked that up.
Oh no.
I didn't even turn the Wii off. I just dropped the controller and walked out of the house. Like, I was just like, done. I'm out. I just walked out the door. Like, that's a degree of frustration that is unfathomable. But there's something about the series that makes you want to get in there. So I don't care what they do with the series, as long as those two gentlemen are involved and it's not a frickin' mobile game. Don't. Please, don't. I can't imagine playing a rhythm-having game with different latencies and different, like, just control responsiveness and just...
No, it worked on DS with the touch controls, but it's still kind of my least favorite for that reason.
Oh, yeah. Basically. Like, anytime it was, like, flick, that was always like, oh, I don't feel great about this. But, you know, if whatever the hell NX is... If it has a built-in screen, that's great for these games because Nintendo knows the latency of everything. Versus on a TV, where if you have bad latency in your TV, some of those later games could be a problem.
Mm, yeah.
But I talked about this with Tadpole Treble. Like, what about we have to wrap this up? But these games work, and this is why it's important that Sun Coup be there, because the gameplay and the music are so intricately linked.
Oh yeah, it's all one piece, basically, you know, isn't it? With these games, that's why I feel like they get to me on a level. I like other rhythm games, but this is my favorite rhythm series, and I think that's probably a big part of it. It's just how integrated they are. It's all, you know, together, and the fact that you've got the musical person, you know, actually overseeing the entire development operation and all that. You know, it's just, yeah, I don't think that's something that happens that often.
Yeah, It's to use Fruits Basket again. It's music. The music is great. And I actually tweeted that as like music of the day one day, because I didn't realize how good that song is until I just heard it. But like the floor is acting like a drum. And when you hit the button, it extends out and that's a drum sound. And like there's art and music mixed there, and you're just adding the percussion to the song. The song sounds great without it, but it sounds even better with it. It's like, oh, this man, these people, this game. But congratulations. Welcome to the Rhythm Heaven Club. I look forward to you screaming at the game because it just won't give you the chance to get that last perfect you've been waiting for. And then you screw it up when you finally get it because Karate Man Senior, like, you didn't press the hold the button just quite long enough. So I have the next email. Jimmy writes, "Hi James, Greg, and Guillaume," in alphabetical order. Don't read anything into it. This question is born out of the tension surrounding the start to E3 this year, but I think it bears at something wider. As you'll remember, the event was preceded by the heartbreaking massacre in Orlando. Many outlets called out several developers whose E3 intro videos highlighted mass violence, which, to put it lightly, did not sit well in the national moment. I guess my question is, with the national introspection, Americans seem... I'm the only American on the episode today, huh? I'm the only American on the show, to be honest, so whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I thought John didn't count.
He doesn't count, no, he doesn't. At least he lives here. Americans seem to be questioning their perspectives on violence. Do you think that there is a chance that we will see games on the whole become less violent in our lifetime? Surely, being a Nintendo podcast, you understand that destructive violence is not necessary for high quality and fun games without shooting and mass violence. Thanks for the show and the marvelous, stupid stream last weekend. All the best." It was stupid. You're right. It was very stupid. It was the stupidest thing I've done for this show in a while. And that's saying a lot. As Jimmy mentioned, the weekend prior to E3, there was a mass shooting in Orlando at a gay nightclub, and I don't remember the number of people who were killed, but it was a lot. It was really, really sobering and just unpleasant. And beyond that, At relatively close before that, I can't remember which. That's the sad thing. I can't remember which attack it was in Europe at that particular moment that had just occurred. And of course, there is violence in the world all over the place in the news all the time right now. And but in general, not necessarily right now, just in general, violence is part of humanity. So yes, but the timing was very unfortunate. And there was this weird, and I'm going to call it weird, and I'm going to explain it why I think it's weird in a moment. Weird response where publishers were excoriated, especially on Monday, for showing violent trailers, quote, in light of the moment. Because Monday, of course, it happened on Saturday going into Sunday, and then Monday was the start of, actually Sunday night was the start of the E3 press cycle because Bethesda does their thing Sunday night. Because it's creeping further and further into the week in front of it. And there was, I wouldn't say it was a wide blowback, but there were some voices who, were upset that content was not cut from presentations, I suppose, is what they would have liked to have seen. But, and this is the part where we're now all kind of talking and we're all able to answer. I was just giving more background. Speaking personally, I think that's a relatively unfair criticism. Because generally speaking, well, first off, I didn't see any of that leveraged at movies coming out in the subsequent weeks. There's always going to be this kind of like, well, games are different mentality to it. But additionally, this is a game. These are video games. This is not real life. And sometimes this is how some people get away from bad experiences, but these are also people's jobs. These are like big, expensive products that are being marketed, and to say like, hey, you need to pivot your entire year's marketing campaign overnight. Like this thing you've been planning for the last 9 months, you need to change everything you were doing in 24 hours because of something that happened completely unrelated to you right now. Is impossible. It is an impossible request. Unless they wanted Bethesda to go out and stage and go, we don't have anything in light of recent events. Here's 25 minutes of Todd Howard's face on a screen. He can't give you any promises he won't keep though because he's not talking. We'll see y'all next year. You're putting, to do that wasn't to critique someone for not changing their entire marketing plan that quickly is essentially asking them to do the impossible and then getting upset when they don't. And so, yes, in the moment, there may have been some bad optics to it, but I think you really have to look at the broader picture here and say that this and this were not related. And to equivocate the two is to do bad things. You are, to even put the two together is really to make a false equivocation because, and this is my favorite statistic ever. People talk about violence in games. The rate of violent crime has gone down in this country consistently overall, not necessarily every year, but it's consistently down since the introduction of video games into homes. Period. End of conversation, end of sentence, end of everything. And therefore, if there is no statistical correlation between the increase of violent games or just video games in general, and in fact, there is a negative with violence, violent crime. There's no causality. So doing that kind of equivocation at this point is either you're making an equivocation there or you're saying it should have been done primarily out of sensitivities. Regardless, it wasn't possible. So it was a bad criticism to make. And I think I don't want to just attribute that to people going like, I'm going to say this thing in the moment and I'm going to get attention for it. That would be despicable. If that's what some of these outlets were doing, if this was clickbaity stuff, I'm going to assume this came from a well-intentioned place, but it's incredibly short-sighted of the realities of the industry and of the investors and of the employees and of the people who have been working on these games for 1, 2, 3, 4 years. And for the marketing campaigns that have been put together for the last 6 to 8 months to plan for E3, the stage shows, the rehearsals, the media buys, all like there is a reality that this thing was rolling, and to ask someone to stop and turn it around on a day's notice is just not possible.
So yeah, so sure, that goes. I think you've touched on the points of like the marketing is hard to, like, it's not a ship that you can turn around all that fast and all that stuff. But I think that we can ask ourselves kind of how games got so violent. Like even if there's no correlation or causation of violence.
I think if you introduce something like this as your starting point for that conversation, you're false emotionally loading that conversation with something that it's not related to. You're basically saying, like, here's this terrible thing, I'm going to use it to try to establish argumentative high ground beforehand.
No, but I mean, I don't know. Like the situation will color the way that we look at fiction. Like it's just like you just can't escape it, right? And it might be unfortunate that, say, EA releases kind of what was it, Battlefield Hardline?
Yes.
Soon after there was kind of like this, that attention was brought to police abuse and police violence, and so, oh hey, look guys, we've got this game where you play as the cops, and we give you like kind of points for not killing the perps, but your rewards are all going to be lethal, and you know, will allow you to better kill the suspects.
But they still had to release that game. Like they still had
to release that game. Yeah, sure. But you can kind of, I don't know, you can ask yourself, like, how did it get to this point? How did we get to, from you know, EA releasing maybe, like, the most violent game that they had was, what, like, some football, Mutant League Football or something? Like, was that them? I don't know. I don't even know, but you know, like the Desert Strike series or whatever, like sure, like there were themes of war and themes of violence in the past, but it used to be that EA would always aim for a T rating because M ratings, they just felt, you know, went too far and would limit the appeal of their games. And now they're like collaborating with cops, with the army, with weapons manufacturers, to create, you know, a significant portion of their games. And I don't know, like, I think that we can feel uncomfortable about that.
We can, but I mean, personally, I don't, because there's lots of other things out there too. I mean, it's
sure
video games. So here's one big thing
but
that
you can't, you know, the fact that, oh yeah, like there's worse out there, or there's other situations, there's other problems, like that shouldn't stop us from looking at one particular problem, because then like the goalposts are always shifted.
And I'm not suggesting you do. I'm suggesting that maybe it's not a problem. That's actually where I'm going with it. Because one thing that's changed, and inarguably has changed, period, is that the average age of video game consumers has been consistently shifting up. And as it has shifted up, it has started to fall more in line with the average age of consumers of movies and television. And so it makes sense that making a game that, if you're saying, like, hey, we're hard stopping on a T rating as a publisher, made a lot more sense as a rule in, say, 1993, when that average age was lower than it does now.
No, I understand that, but, and you mentioned this, like, games are different than movies and TV shows. Like, games have more, I think, of a gun fetishism.
I would argue they're treated differently. I don't argue that they're different. Have you seen Taken? Liam Neeson basically masturbates over his guns in Taken.
Yeah, like, and I've seen like the first season of 24 and stuff like that. And sure, like the violence in television has also escalated. But I do think that video games have taken things usually, you know, several steps further. Like several games will collaborate with the army. Like video game developers have worked on recruiting tools for the U.S. Army. You know, like,
I mean,
they sit at the table with those guys and they work out ways to kind of make the you know, the armed forces more appealing.
Top Gun. There are the Navy was all over that movie.
Yeah. And this isn't new. The CIA was all about Oliver Zero Dark 30, and then it turns out that, hey, look, like they kind of represented themselves way in a way better light than, you know.
Well, sure.
And that game, that game, well, that movie was touted as like this realistic depiction of what happened, like the final hours before Bin Laden was killed. And I don't know where I'm going with this. Like, it's just like, it seems like it's a little bit less frequent with movies and TV shows than it has been with games.
I think it's less frequent in part because it's not mentioned as much. I mean, the U.S. military contributes to a lot of production of film. Either it's making materials available, because guess what? No matter how much budget Michael Bay gets, he's not going to get enough money to buy a fucking M1 A2 Abrams. Like, there's a point where Fox is like, no, Michael, you can't have a tank. We don't trust you with it. And at some point, they need to get help representing that in his latest metal robots scream at each other for 3 hours while shit blows up and occasionally Megan Fox bends over movie. But
okay. So sure. Okay. So there's the movies and TV shows can collaborate also with like weapons makers and stuff like that. But there's also the way that they approach topics can also be way more, you know, you can have Taken, but you can also have something much more, I don't know, nuanced, you know, like.
More nuanced than Tank.
I know. But I mean, like.
Look, he doesn't know who you are, but he has a very nuanced set of skills with which he will divide the line between violence and reality.
No, but you know, like,
I
brought up
the Bowie knife.
I brought up the example of Battlefield Hardline, but you know, like, there have been countless TV shows where, you know, someone involved with the law, some ex-cop or whoever, have been consultant or have started series. And like, are we going ever to see, you know, a take on the war on drugs that's as nuanced as The Wire was in video games? Or
yes.
Are we always going to be stuck, you know, shooting a gun in first person at every freaking cokehead that we see?
My answer for you would be yes, we will. And my follow-on to that is, and it's not fair to ask for it yet. And I say that because one of the things I studied in school was I spent multiple classes in film history, television history. I even did some radio history, broadcasting stuff. And one of the things that we had to do as an assignment was we had to watch a shitload of old content and old movies. So stuff from the silent era into, I would say, the first good movie, like first movie I saw now and walked away thinking, that was actually a good movie. It was in the 30s, I guess. I know there are some movies that are held in regard from the late 20s, but that was already like 40 plus years into cinema. Mm-hmm. Like, it took them that long to get good at making a movie. And first it was technology. The technology just wasn't there to make a good, compelling story. But then it was just the art. It took about two generations for people to really get to the point where they were reflecting on what had primarily been movies about, man, how many guys dressed as Indians can we kill? To make a nuanced depiction of the conflict in the American West. Because somebody finally watched enough of those and said, I can make a compelling action film that actually has some degree of story to it. And that took, like, that particular topic ran you right through the Westerns of the 50s and 60s. Like, that didn't really start landing until the 80s. TV did the same thing. Early television is a mix of live things sponsored by Geritol, variety programs, and just awful, 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 awful sitcoms. Like, just one after, like, watching, one of the things we did was we watched, like, a block of, like, this was the CBS broadcast for this evening that affiliates could use. And everything on it was terrible. And not terrible by like, wow, look at the low technology here. Just terrible. Just awful game shows, awful like dramatic shows, awful comedies. And it took a while for us to get to nuance. The Wire was groundbreaking because it was that nuanced. And it took until The Wire came out for something like that to happen. You know, you see, The Sopranos is another example of like, yeah, it's a gangster show, but it spends a lot of time talking about just family dynamics. Those series are well remembered because they are the exception and because it did take a while to get there and because they did subvert the norms of the genre they exist in. I would argue that right now, Battlefield Hardline, for all of its faults and for all of its bad timing, Like, it was a Battlefield game where the primary mechanic, reward cycle mechanic, was not killing. Like, it was somebody trying. They just didn't get there. Like, they had the thought. They made the effort. They just didn't get there. And their timing made it worse. And the optics of the whole thing were terrible. And I remember being in E3 where they talked about they were going to have a police raid on a building to show off how awesome they were. But they were like 8 miles from E3, so nobody saw it. And you thought, EA, what is wrong with you? But that's what I'm talking about. Like, the cycle of having to do this stuff, having to promote these things, and having to try to make a big, loud splash sort of right now, at this moment, doesn't allow the maturity of the medium to really shine yet. Right now, everybody is trying to be Michael Bay. At some point, you will start to see people willing to be something else. And we're already seeing it in smaller game space, and not just indie games. We see it in... Here's a good example. Ace Attorney series, for all of its faults, is very violent. There are regularly people shot and killed, depicted, dead, on the ground, blood. But at the same time, it doesn't fetishize its violence.
Yeah, but the discussion, and I know that Ace Attorney was at E3, but yeah, I think that indie stuff can do something, you know, some more interesting things, but they're kind of excluded from the conversation.
But that's the same as film. Like we were talking about it beforehand. It's the $150 million films are your fucking cinematic universe battleship movie. They are your Transformers 6 revenge of this crappy shit that we've got now.
But you also get, you know, which I didn't really enjoy it that much, but Interstellar or Gravity or, you know, you've got other films about other topics
that do
generate interest, generate like big box office, and it seems like it's a little bit more rare with games. It seems like we're kind of stuck with just Michael Bay sometimes.
I think we'll get there. It's funny we're having this conversation. Now, I didn't even think about this when I put the email in. I was bitching about movies before we started what was out, and there's actually not a lot of Michael Bay this summer. It's just cheap, crappy comedies. And we have those right now. We have the cheap, like this game. We have kind of the art housey stuff. We have the stuff that tries to be art housey stuff, but comes off looking sad. And we have the actiony stuff. It's the drama, good comedy and good drama in mediums is what develops later. And it's what takes longer. It's what takes experimenting with the format and figuring out what works there. We have David Cage trying to make his cinematic masterpiece, and it fails over and over again because he doesn't understand how to use the medium correctly. Press X to Jason does not create drama. It just comes off as stupid. People need time to really get good in the medium, to get into the medium, to understand what makes it flows, to grow up creating games. And this is right now, people our age are the first generation who really grew up creating games. Like their whole life had video games, started tinkering with games at a young age, and are now getting into making them professionally. And I think somewhere in there is where we're going to start to see that transition. Because the problem is you can't just have somebody who wants to tell a story and then go, hey, go make my game. Because you end up with games that don't feel like games. They feel like interactive stories. You need someone who is both a game designer who's going to make compelling gameplay and also wants to tell a story. And that takes a lot of skills that are really difficult to bring together. And that's what the difference between like having a good director on a film and a director who didn't hurt the film. Like somebody who can competently shoot someone else's script and somebody who can take a script and make it, you know, make it better. And I just don't know that we're there yet. I think the medium will get there. And I think the idea that games fetishize violence in a way differently than other things do, I think is a bit of a misnomer. I think we just don't have that softer edge of showing violence in context, because right now either it's done to drive a story or it's done to show flashy gameplay. Somewhere in the middle we'll get there. It's finding the priority of what's going to keep the player entertained that offers something that a movie can't, but still has nuance, and putting nuance when the player has to play the game without it just being them just being yakked at like I'm doing right now is difficult. And I think that's where we're struggling with it. I think that's why you have stuff like Spec Ops, where the people who thought Spec Ops had like deep, like really deep representative thought, and people who thought Spec Ops was boring. Because somewhere they were trying to walk that line and didn't quite hit it. Which is funny because the game is called Spec Ops The Line. Ha. Huh? But I think we'll get there. I really honestly believe we'll get there.
The one thing I would say, other than the maturation and the medium point that you've made, James, is demographics. You know, you spoke about that a bit in terms of VR. Obviously, it's been aging up inevitably. And also, you know, the male-female imbalance has been getting redressed, and that will continue, and I think that will probably contribute more to games having a bit of a less sort of violent tilt, I would have thought, because you know the people that are, you know, you talk about people coming into contact with games you know at a young age and going on, well, people that are coming into contact with games at a young age now and going on may well be mobile games.
Right.
You know, and as far as I'm aware, are not necessarily, you know, all based on violence, or, you know, it might be like, colorful Match 3 stuff or whatever, you know, kind of the social stuff, or Pokemon Go, of course, is, you know, making big way. I feel like, and, you know, that, if there is a graduation, which is something that Nintendo wants to do, of mobile players to more dedicated game stuff, that you know, in the future the money might not just be in the, you know, the gritty shoot everything kind of games so much, once you know, the demographics for the people who are going to be the market that's going to be buying high production value games has been sort of changed by the production line of mobile. You know, mobile produces a different roster of gamers than, you know, the NES did, and the Super NES and all those other generations did. So I think it's inevitably going to change, whether anybody wants it to or not, whether anybody thinks it's a good thing or not, whether, you know, it is immaterial. It will change, and it will be less, violence dominated in the future. I really do believe that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, it's not like the NES games that we had. Like, sure, like we had Contra and games where there were guns, but it's not like it's not like the line between Contra and kind of the, you know, Battlefield, Call of Duty.
It's more of a PC thing. You know, I would assume Doom and all that kind of stuff.
It's really when Western developers, PC developers started kind of gaining in popularity on consoles that we started seeing more and more first-person shooters. And
no, that's right. Which is, you know, where, you know, I think it's pertinent to speak about the American market, you know, because that's a lot of what, you know, you're talking about American developers. So in some cases not, but it's usually dictated to by the desires of the American market because it's the big prize. You know, so that's kind of the leading factor. But, you know, you see, in other markets, it's different, and I think in America it will change, just because, you know, the kinds of people who are gaming will change. But at the same time, I don't think those games are going to go away altogether either, because you look at, you know, movies, which are a lot more mature as a medium and as a business and all that, and you still do have a preponderance of, you know, action pictures and you know, bad guys getting shot movies and stuff. But,
of course,
you know, they are, you know, I think blockbusters have generally got a lot more kind of colourful and more fanciful over, less sort of hardcore over the years, you know, as it seems to be like they've had been.
Less Charles Bronson and more like Pain and Gain.
Well, to be fair, the Bronson movies of the 80s were never blockbusters.
Yeah,
But they were gun fetishization. Like,
oh, yeah.
Nothing beyond, like, no video game has ever touched, like, Death Wish 3.
No, few things have, but, you know, I mean, the point I would make is that, you know, yes, you've still got those movies, but I do feel like, they're not as prevalent as they were, you know, in the past in some ways, because the money has moved a bit. You know, the money is not in having, you know, an ultra violent film, because, you know, that limits your audience. You know, and that's why the, you know, things like the superhero movies and all that are bigger at the box office now. because it's the kind of thing that you can pull in from both older and younger demos.
Well, and I would
assume that that is the kind of thing you'll see, and also, you know, more sort of male and female rather than just so skewed towards male. So I think that it's going to happen in games too. But yeah, they're not going to go away altogether. No one is asking that.
I would argue it already has happened though, because look at one of the most successful games of the year is Overwatch. And while it is a shooter, ultimately, there is shooting in that game. That game is cartoony and comic book and Marvel Cinematic Universe-y in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Like it tries to be witty. It's kind of successful at that. It tries to be colorful and cartoonish and, you know, over-exaggerated and crazy, and it's everything the DC Cinematic Universe isn't, which is dark and brooding and gross. And I think we'll see. We've always had these games, and I think they can be successful in conjunction with other stuff. I think the reality situation is E3 in particular, if we're going to talk about E3, is speaking to such a specific group in the video games industry that even if those games become a smaller percentage, if E3 continues to exist, which in and of itself is an open question, yeah, I think we're going to continue to see those be the games that get featured because they're the games that had the $160 trillion budget that they had to cover. So they need to put them in front of everybody's eyes as much as possible. But we spent a lot of time on this question because I think there's a lot to unpack there. So, Greg.
Okay, so Freestyle writes, first off, I would like to say that it's interesting to see a podcast that has moved from talking about Nintendo to a podcast about watching two people slowly dive deeper into insanity. Also, Guy and Greg are there.
Who's the
anyway,
other person?
Onto the question, yes, indeed. With the recent takedowns of AM2R, the archives of Nintendo Power and Pokemon Uranium, why do you guys think NOA are doing these takedowns now of all times? Do you think that this will happen to other fan games such as Mother 4 and Pokemon Showdown?
Yes.
Keep up the great podcast.
I haven't heard of those two projects, but the answer is yes.
Yeah, it will.
Eventually, I mean, like, as we saw with AM2R, it might be, you know, a long time before they finally wield, you know, their right to assert their copyright and all that, but they'll do it eventually. Because they're obliged to,
right.
You know, in legal terms, you have to demonstrate, that they have standing if ever their copyright was sort of infringed upon by people with less kind of benign motives than the fans who were making these games.
Well, and in the case of something like AM2R, There's sprite work in there that's theirs. There's audio in there that's theirs, sound effects. But there's also, and this doesn't get talked about a lot, people say, well, why don't they just redraw the sprites and stuff? The character designs are still theirs, but so are the level designs. Even level designs are copywritten. This is just a game and all associated works. And that's a big part of it. So that game being a remake of Metroid 2, all of the content, even the stuff that was created new, is still protected under their copyright. So the fact they acted on it isn't surprising. The fact that they didn't act on it until after it was out, like, maybe that was kind of like okay, we have to do this, but we don't necessarily need to do it right now. We might let it get out there because we don't give a shit.
Yeah, and to somewhat diffuse the negative PR that would inevitably accrue
right.
from doing it.
Because, I mean, they know it's out there now. They know the takedown notice was largely symbolic because it's on the internet. Once it's out there, it's out there. Hmm. I think something like a Mother 4... If you're making Mother 4 right now, stop. Don't never, ever, ever, unless you are fucking Shigesato Itoi, you should not be making sequels to games, period. Like, that's, I think that goes beyond just like a licensing thing to just being disrespectful. Like, it's one thing to make your fan fiction, but to go and say, this is the fourth Mother game, fuck you. No, it's not. And even if Nintendo never makes another Mother game, you did not make Mother 4. I think that's gross. And yes, Nintendo will take that down too.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, you could argue the imperative is more clear in the case of something like the Metroid 2 remake. Cause it's like, I mean, I don't assume, I can only imagine they're not making tremendous bank off it, but They have Metroid 2 for sale today.
Right.
On the eShop.
Yes.
That is a revenue stream, and this is a superior version.
Because that is a bad game.
Of that game for free, you know.
Yes.
You know, it could actually take away some revenue that they otherwise would have made. I mean, you know, I doubt that was actually the motivating factor for what they did. I assume it's more just, you know, sort of the proper maintenance of their, you know, legal position. But, you know, that is a fact. So I think they're well within their rights to assert themselves in that way. With a sort of fan sequel, it's different, you know, and a lot of the times it is going to happen when it is a series that's been dormant or presumed dead. So, you know, in that case, obviously, it's difficult to say, it's difficult to demonstrate that you're kind of addressing an issue of like, well, they're kind of diverting revenue away from us.
You're just presenting
with their
your
fan
brand
game. In that case, it's more of a creative issue, I feel like, you know, that, you know, in terms of, especially when you've got a strong sort of author in the case of the Mother series.
Right.
You know, like Itoi, I'm a little uncomfortable with the notion of, you know, somebody kind of appropriating that. But at the same time, you know, like they're passionate about it. They want to make it, you know, I it's certainly not for me to say they shouldn't, but I also understand why Nintendo or any of these other companies that deal with these issues, are ultimately gonna, you know, wield the power they have.
Right. I will say it. You should not call it Mother 4. That is disrespectful. You can call it Mother something else, but that is fucking disrespectful because you are not making Mother 4. You are not Shigesato. You can call this Mother 4 my fan game, but 4 is not okay.
And as for the timing issues here, I mean, some of this is just, it's a sort of unhappy coincidence, a cluster.
Yep.
Of these things that just happened. I mean, obviously, the timing of AM2R was very specific to the 30th anniversary of the franchise. And then I assume the Pokemon stuff is just because of the you know, the Pokemania at the moment. It's, you know, this is when you're going to get eyes on Pokemon stuff. If you've been cooking up fan Pokemon games for years, you know, now is the time.
Yeah.
You know, to do something. So I think, you know, I'm sure it's not that, you know, Nintendo, you know, has been sitting there just letting fan games fly by for years, and now all of a sudden they're flexing their muscles. It's, you know, it's more out of their control when they have to do that.
Well, and especially AM2R got a lot of attention in media circles and stuff. So they had to act on that one because there's a certain amount of like, well, we didn't know, so we're still protecting our brands actively. But like in this case, it's they.
Yeah. There's no, if a tree falls in the forest, stuff
right.
going
you
on
got,
here. You, know?
You got too big. We have to do something kind of deal. But to some degree, like, so we talk about the Nintendo Power stuff. I don't know who owns the rights to issues of Nintendo Power. Who owns the rights to the back issues of Nintendo Power? I'm not sure who owns the content, but somebody does. And presumably, I mean, there's no fair use implications here if you're just dumping scans of every single issue on the internet. Like that's far and away not fair use. That's just straight up like here they are. You can have them. Like, again, it's one of the situations where if they are the rights holder to that content, and again, they might be. Like, they totally might be. I would have thought it would have been Future. Because I didn't Future.
Well, they bought it, didn't they?
Yeah.
For the last few years of its run.
But if they do have the right, maybe Future didn't get the rights to the back catalog.
Yeah, that is different, I guess. And you know, what sort of, you're getting into the different, like, the language of the contract. Oh, God,
right.
What
a contract that we will never see. That is no longer relevant because the magazine is dead. But again, this could be
It probably does have contingencies though in it.
Oh, I'm sure it does.
Time for you know, things like
in the event the magazine shuts down, like,
and digital republishing and all this kind of stuff. You know, I mean, it would have been short-sighted if it didn't. So
yeah.
Again, you know, there are certain sort of rights and responsibilities that come with
a legal
contract like
and
that.
And in this case, a company like Nintendo who Nintendo's value as a company, their value, just like more so than even a company like Disney, comes from the value of their properties. and the big fat stack cash they have on hand. But like they're the most valuable thing they own is their shares in Pokemon. It's Mario. It's Zelda. The brands that they control are their most valuable asset. Period. It's not their fancy new building. It's not their office outside Seattle. It's not the fact that, well, it might be the fact that cash they have, but like, so they have to be active in policing it, and they may not hit everything, and they may not hit things as soon as they show up. But if something really rises to the top, they got to hit it. And they've got attorneys. I'm sure they've got executive attorneys. They've got attorneys. They've got a retainer in every major region, and whose only job it is to police this stuff and probably act largely independently of Nintendo. They know this thing is out there. They go take care of it. They contact him and go say, hey, we're going to do something on this. We'll send you the bill. And it sucks people who made these games. And I get these are works of passion and really going out there and trying to do something for a franchise you love. And I think, the comments I saw from the people who are working on AM2R speak, they largely, they're like, yeah, we know. But at the same time, they still put out a patch to that game. So Nintendo's not really hit them. They hit somebody who was hosting the game. Obviously Nintendo hasn't given them a cease and desist because they released a patch to the game after it happened. So at some point, like, Nintendo's not going after this as aggressively as they could, but they're going after it enough. And I wouldn't read too much into it. I think Greg more or less said the same thing. But it's not like you can't still find these games if you want to. They're still out there. But yes, to Guillaume's point, the other ones mentioned in this email will eventually get hit too. It is just a matter of time.
So do we think that Nintendo could possibly have given, I don't know, like, do they give these people making these projects like a chance to kind of backtrack and change the art before sending their cease and desists? Like,
I mean,
are they waiting? Like, okay, well, if it's for his personal use, like, he can create the Metroid 2 remake that he wants. But as soon as it hits the internet, then we send a cease and desist.
Well, I mean, you could create anything you want in your house and not release it. Like, who's gonna?
Right. And so far, like,
Schrodinger's Metroid the game, remake.
There was no. As far as I know, there was no beta, right? That was released, like.
There was, I believe there's a beta. A beta, but it was a while ago, like a really while ago. And then he went radio silent, and then suddenly, like, bang, here it is.
Right.
Okay. I don't know that Nintendo reaches out to them, but certainly you could go back and just replace the sprite work. If you remade the stages, like I said, you'd have to remake the stages again because the stages can't be copies of existing stages from a game. Those are also a trademark or also copywritten. You'd have to recycle some of the stages. You'd have to change some of the power-ups. You'd have to grate Gianna Sisters this game, essentially. Actually, that's a great example. Grate Gianna Sisters was a game that came out on all of the home computers that were popular in Europe.
Yep.
And it was originally pitched to Nintendo as a, hey, we want to port Super Mario Brothers to all these home computers. Look what you'll get to play if people can play Mario on a fucking Spectrum. It'll be great. And Nintendo basically said, stop, and also we're going to sue you for making this. And their answer was, oh, we'll just change it to Sisters. We'll change the Goombas and put little wings on them, and they're owls now. But the stage layout is still way too similar. And so when Great Gianna Sisters got remade for DS, the stage layout does not look like Super Mario Brothers. It got heavily, heavily shifted and altered and changed. So you can totally do that. You can totally take your copyrighted material that you've made a fan product of, remix it enough, and then release it as something else. And in the case of something like AMR2, if you're going to sit there and spend, I can't remember how many years he worked on that game, but really, really, really long time. You have to know, like, I can't sell this for sure. Should I just go rebrand it and say, hey, it's inspired by this game super heavily. But now that I've made it my own thing, I can actually sell it. And I'm kind of surprised he didn't. Like, it shows that really cares about this product.
This yeah, part. I think it's because it's for that franchise. It's for, you know, it can't be anything else.
Right.
You know, it's the zero emission treatment for Metroid 2, and yep. it needs it. You
oh
know?
Yeah,
like
that's kind of
an imperative to it that I think drives it. That
our retroactive for that game is negative.
It's you know, that I think is, you know, what drove it was just, you know, like it's passion project. And so I don't think there was any ever change in it, but everything I've read suggests that they had very realistic expectations about what would happen.
Yeah. And I think if you're going to make a fan project, you have to. But at the same time, Nintendo, like I said, I'm fairly confident there was a beta. Nintendo could have killed it in the womb, but they didn't. And it seems like they did the bare minimum to fulfill their role in this dance. And it's just it's just the reality of, if you're a company whose value is tied to its brands, you got to do something about it. You have to kind of protect them. You know, I've heard people ask, why didn't they just say, well, we'll buy this game off you and then we'll release it? Well, A, he made it for PC, so it wouldn't run anything Nintendo owns. But B, that kind of sets a precedent that they're probably not willing to go into. People are pointing to that Sonic fan game team that's making the new Sonic 2D game. But like I said, Nintendo's value is tied up in the value of their brands. Sega's value is tied up in Soccer Manager. So, like...
Yeah, Nintendo is quite insular as well compared to, you know, maybe like Western developers that might recruit from modding communities and things like that. You know, it's Nintendo's much more insular than that.
Sega's value is tied up in getting Totino's pizza rolls all over their fucking streams. Like, there's a difference there, and those companies are not in a comparable situation in the year of our Lord 2016, and. Don't attempt to compare the actions of Nintendo being who they are and the completely irrational agent that is Sega's current marketing plans and Sega's business plans, because I don't know what the hell they're doing 95% of the time. That's going to do it for email this week. Three emails. God, we've got to fix this. But you can send us emails that we'll talk way too long about to RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com. You can send us your comments, questions, and thoughts, and we might just read them on the show. I know I teased retroactive like 4.5 months ago. We still haven't settled it. We're getting closer in that we actually talked about it, which is progress for us. And we'll have an announcement for that soon. Additionally, there's some stuff that we want to plug on here. If you only listen to the numbered episodes of the show, which... I've seen the numbers. People do that. Last week, Greg sat down with Johnny and did a catch-up. I'm talking about, like, Greg's not here. Hey, Greg, why don't you tell us about it real quick?
I did. I spoke with Johnny for more than an hour and a half, and being the magnanimous man that I am, I made it available to the listeners.
An hour and 41 minutes is the exact runtime of that. Thank you having to do the RSS feeds. And
you're breaking my heart.
I'm probably wrong, too. That's the sad part.
I'm pretty sure that's right.
I also did a terrible idea, and I did a stream, then Seren and Don crashed it. You can find that. I'll have it in the article where I was like, hey, we'll just play games that you want me to play, chat. I'm sure we'll have some good time in the eShop. We'll have a good time by everybody. And then Don and Seren came in and are like, no, we're not going to have a good time. You play the Perplexing Orb and you like it.
I mean, it's like somebody allowing themselves to be tied up and then being shocked when the whip comes out. I mean, come on, James.
I wish it was the whip. It was like a fucking gun. Talk about gun fetishization. Oh, my God. Man. Like, if you wanted to know how bad the depths of the eShop is and you've avoided Don's YouTube channel... there's a point in that video where I start like screaming, no, we're going to play City Connection. Because that seems like a reprieve, a game where you're a car who shoots cats into space when he runs into them. Like that was a plus. So that's out there if you so desire, but that is going to do it for the show this week. Greg.
It's Guillaume this week.
True. Guillaume, what is our music to end the show with?
I've been getting back into Etrian Odyssey Untold, and again, as I said, Yuzo Koshiro provided the soundtrack to my summer, so...
Now he can provide the soundtrack to your summer!
Yes, of course, a lot of the compositions in that game are quite nice, and the game has both, like, the DS original FM synth versions of the soundtracks and orchestrated, real-life instrument versions. But let's listen to the original synthy version of The Withered Forest from Etrian Odyssey.
And you don't have to pay us $8 to hear it.
That's right. Although you can, I mean...
Send your $8 to RFN at NintendoRollReport.com. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.